This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, the MOVE organization will hold a three-day event to dispel confusion about why the Philadelphia police killed 11 of their members, burned out a whole city block, and put 9 MOVE people in prison for life in the 1970s and 80s. And an advocate for the people of the Congo says it may be a good thing that Donald Trump doesn't yet have a policy on Africa.
But first, the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law and other law firms have sued the state of Louisiana for denying poor defendants even the semblance of adequate legal counsel. Lawyers Committee President Kristen Clark says Louisiana violates the Constitution by depriving people charged with crimes with the means to defend themselves. And that's why the state is the incarceration capital of the world.
Louisiana has the highest incarceration of any state in the United States. In fact, more than most countries across the globe, it is widely viewed as the incarceration capital of the world. When you are arrested, if you are poor, the Constitution is clear. You must be provided an attorney. And in every respect, what we have found is evidence that makes clear that Louisiana has the most broken public defender system of any state in our country. They lock people up at alarmingly high rates, many of them for low-level and nonviolent crimes, and then fail to provide lawyers to stand by those folks to navigate their way through the criminal justice system. It's unconstitutional, it's unlawful, and we've filed suit to bring justice to people who literally have been defenseless for far too long.
Last year, the public defender system in Louisiana basically ground to a halt, but people still kept on getting put in jail.
Many of our clients in this case have literally spent months in jail without any contact with an attorney, without anyone who has come to explain the charges that they face, without anyone who's come to explain the evidence that has been presented against them, or someone to outline the timeline for getting before a judge. This case is a class action lawsuit because we know that the problems are rampant all across the state. While we were investigating, we spent time on the ground in different parishes across the state watching what happened, and it was alarming. You had defendants who appeared before court who were seeing their attorney for the very first time. This is a crisis, and we filed this lawsuit to bring justice because it's long overdue for people in the state of Louisiana.
You say that Louisiana falls far below national standards in terms of providing adequate defense. But is the national standard itself adequate?
Well, here's how Louisiana really stands out. It is the only state in the country that relies primarily on fines and fees, court fines and fees, in order to fund its public defender system. Other states will have budgets that are set aside by state lawmakers to provide for a sufficiently supported public defender system, but not in Louisiana. It is a system that is financed on the backs of poor people. And it really creates this perverse incentive for public defenders to fail. There's more money that goes into the system if fines and fees are levied upon indigent defendants. It's a crude user pay system that is completely out of alignment with the rest of the country. So Louisiana is rock bottom when it comes to the way that they structure, set up, and finance their public defender system. But more importantly, their system violates the Constitution, and it's a wrong that must be righted.
And you were citing the very long delays that exist in this Louisiana system. Folks say that justice delayed is justice denied, but it looks like in Louisiana, justice doesn't arrive at all.
That's right. One of our clients in our case is a gentleman named Michael Carter. He's 27, and he's been in jail since the summer of 2015. He faces firearm charges and other charges that could put him in jail for up to 20 years. But in the year and a half that he has been jailed, he's never received a visit from his attorney. And he's been kept at a jail that is located 3 hours from Baton Rouge, where his family lives. His mother has lost her home. It's been very distressful for him to be behind bars with no way to contact his family in a meaningful way, but more importantly, no contact from an attorney. This violates the Constitution. It's unlawful and it's unethical and incredibly unjust.
Now, people like the young man that you just talked about, you'd like to group the many thousands of them who've been denied adequate legal defense into one class so that you can have a viable class action suit.
That's right. We know that there are vast numbers of people who have been impacted across the state of Louisiana. As noted, Louisiana's the incarceration, bears the reputation as the incarceration capital of the world. There is no state, no country that locks people up at higher rates than the state of Louisiana. And it is time that we correct this grave injustice. This is a racial justice crisis. We know that the disproportionate number of people who are sucked into the system are African American. African Americans make up a third of the state's population, but make up nearly 70% of those sitting inside jails and prisons. And when they are poor and not able to provide a lawyer for themselves, the state bears that obligation. It's what the Constitution requires. It's what the Supreme Court has affirmed. And we are fighting this case to help correct an enormous wrong that has been perpetrated on the people of the state of Louisiana.
There seems to be a consensus among the political class in Louisiana and a continuity of mass incarceration in that state. One of the defendants in your suit is Governor John Bel Edwards. He's praised down there as a kind of New South liberal Democrat by Louisiana standards.
My organization, the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, we are nonpartisan. Politics in no way influences or shapes why we've brought this case. We've brought this case merely because there is an injustice here. There is a tremendous problem with this broken system. There is a violation of the Constitution that must be corrected. And we've named in our case those individuals who are necessary to bring relief. The governor, the state legislature, these are all parties that are necessary to help correct what is wrong with the public defender system in Louisiana. This is not a system that should be financed on the backs of poor people. It's time for the state legislature and state officials to work together to set aside proper funding, adequate funding, to make sure that they are meeting their obligation to provide counsel to the poor.
And have you been getting some cooperation and collaboration from the Black Caucus in the legislature in Louisiana?
So far, we are fighting this battle in the courts, and at the appropriate time, the legislature will need to take a step back and figure out how it can fix its broken system. I'm very hopeful that the Black Caucus, which has a long reputation of pursuing civil rights work and pursuing interests to benefit the African-American community in the state will be an ally and supporter in the goal that we are working towards. But at the end of the day, this is an injustice that just has been carried out for far too long.
Is there any history of the federal government intervention on this issue in that state, Louisiana?
In recent time, there has not been evidence of federal government intervention here. There was a recent lawsuit brought in the state of New York to address their broken public defender system. Adequate funding is so key and critical here. But part of what we hope will come from our lawsuit is a re-examination of the way the criminal justice system operates in Louisiana. You have vast numbers of people who are locked up at every turn for low-level and nonviolent offenses. You have jails and prisons where there is tremendous overcrowding, and you have a system that is based on, you know, that is financed by the fines and fees imposed on the backs of poor people. Hopefully this case will open up a dialogue about ways to repair the overall criminal justice system in Louisiana, which, from our view, incarcerates too many people at every turn.
And if you're successful in Louisiana, what other states have similar kinds of funding, for example, situations for public defenders and such, that might then be good targets for the same kind of legal action?
We'll see where this battle takes us next. But the Supreme Court issued a ruling decades ago, Gideon versus Wainwright, which makes plain and clear that the Constitution requires that states provide counsel to the poor. Poor people have a right to counsel in our country. And Louisiana was absolutely rock bottom when it comes to living up to its obligation under that Supreme Court ruling and under the Constitution. So for now, we're going to focus our time and energy on correcting the injustice that we see play out in Louisiana. We know that race infects the criminal justice system at every turn. So we are going to fight this battle till the very end and then figure out where we turn to next. We know that there has not been enough focus on ensuring that states live up to their obligation under that Supreme Court ruling. This is important work, and it is work that we will pursue in 2017 and beyond.
That was Kristen Clark, president of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law in Washington.
In 1985, Philadelphia police bombed the residence of the MOVE organization, killing 11 of the group's members, including 5 children, and burning down a whole city block. 8 years earlier, 9 MOVE members were sentenced to life in prison in the death of a policeman. But MOVE keeps on moving, and on May 5th, we'll hold a 3-day event in Philadelphia to counter decades of disinformation about the group. Ramona Africa is MOVE's Minister of Communications.
The media, people who have gotten to know us or who don't even know us, think that they're experts on MOVE. So a lot of misinformation, some that people think is supporting MOVE, other information that is completely defamatory, not true at all. So at this point, the MOVE organization feels like it's past time for us, for MOVE, to tell people what MOVE really believes in, who John Africa is, and why this government wants to exterminate MOVE. MOVE needs to tell people that. Nobody else can tell it better or more accurately than MOVE. So we put together this 3-day conference in May 5th, 6th, and 7th, and we're going to start Friday, May 5th, from 6 to 9, telling people exactly who John Africa is, what exactly MOVE believes in, and why we are such a threat to this system. On Saturday and Sunday, all day from 10 to 6, we will be going into detail into MOVE history. People may know about the 1978 police attack on MOVE under the regime of Frank L. Rizzo. People may know about the bombing of MOVE in 1985. But people don't really know what led up to those things, what happened along the way of those things. And we're going to have various panels of MOVE people and some longtime MOVE supporters who were around through it all or through major parts of it. And we're really going to give people the opportunity to get it straight from the horse's mouth, as they say, so that people can really understand what's going on here with MOVE and with the system's attacks on MOVE. It's free. It's at Universal Auden Reed Charter High School in South Philadelphia. And people can go to our website on a MOVE. That's onamove.com to get the same and more specific information.
We should note that Mumia Abu-Jamal, when he was a radio reporter in Philadelphia, gave consistent coverage to MOVE. That put him in direct confrontation with the police and can be considered one of the factors that led to him becoming a political prisoner.
In fact, we have a video on MOVE that started in 1977 and went up through the 78 police attack on MOVE and a short bit of the aftermath. And there was a press conference held by Rizzo and other city officials, Ed Rendell, directly after the attack on MOVE. And at that point, on or in that interview, I believe it was Rizzo, made it a point to single Mumia out. So, yep, they were after him, definitely after him, because they could not get him to compromise or back off. Mumia, as you said, was a radio journalist. He worked for NPR for a good while. And they tried to use his career to intimidate him and get him to back off because they knew he was a rising star. But they could not intimidate, coerce, or bribe him with his career. That is not what was important to Mumia, or not the most important thing. Mumia, as he became known, is the voice of the voiceless. And that's what he dedicated his life to and still does. He wanted to and still wants to be the voice of the voiceless, to expose issues that are vital to the people. So when they saw with Mumia that they couldn't bribe him or intimidate him, just like with MOVE, they really wanted to get rid of him. If they could have killed him that night, I know they would have. That's how those running this system operate. They'll come with the soft sell initially, like with Mumia's career, or like with MOVE, they offered us money and jobs and all of that stuff. But when that doesn't work, when they see you can't be bribed or bought off, then they come with the iron fist of oppression. And they will come at you with everything they've got, like they have done with MOVE and Mumia.
Now, lots of people are familiar with the bombing of MOVE and the burning down of a whole block, and you were the sole survivor, as you mentioned, back in 1985. But most people don't know how the MOVE 9, a decade earlier, wound up in prison.
What happened over the years, MOVE did not start out demonstrating at police stations, etc. MOVE started out with peaceful demonstrations at the zoo, at the circus, at unsafe boarding homes for the elderly, peaceful demonstrations against Dow Chemical, DuPont Chemical for poisoning the earth, the air, the water. And that's what we started out doing. When we would not stop, when the government tried to tell us we could not demonstrate, blah, 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 and we confronted them about it, you know, as to why we could not have demonstrations. I mean, it says so right in the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence. What does it say? Except MOVE, you know? And when we would not back down, that's when the brutality started. MOVE men were beat bloody, beat into broken limbs and concussions. MOVE women were beat the same. Pregnant MOVE women were beat, stomped, kicked into miscarriage. And MOVE people took a stand. We said, listen, we are a peaceful people. We are uncompromisingly opposed to violence, but we are neither stupid nor confused. We understand clearly, thanks to John Africa, the difference between violence and self-defense. You are not violent when you defend yourself, but you are violent if you allow yourself to be assaulted and you refuse to defend yourself. That's what's against the law, because then you are encouraging and endorsing violence. And MOVE people made it clear, look, you come at us, we don't care who you are, next door neighbor, cop, judge, rich person, poor person, whatever. You come at us, we're going to defend ourselves. Well, of course, government officials did not want to hear that and did not want us influencing people with that kind of simple, clear information. So as the brutality continued, we had babies killed by cops, a three-week-old baby, MOVE baby, trampled to death. We said, oh, no, you know, we're not sitting by quietly for that. And there was a year-long standoff between MOVE and the cops and this system, actually. The only thing that they could come up with is that they wanted us evicted from our home. They said there were housing code violations, and there may have been. But two things. One, they were only like no screens in the windows, and we didn't have electricity and gas in our house. We had wood-burning stoves that we used for heat and to cook on, and we didn't use electricity. We had candles and lamps, battery-operated lamps. But they tried to use that to say they were housing code violations. The second thing is, when has this government ever cared about black people living in what they say is substandard housing? I mean, isn't that happening all across the country? But they misuse that to try to muster up an excuse to come in on MOVE. And that was what the August 8th police attack in 78 under Rizzo was supposedly based on. It was plainly, just like in 85, a plan, a plot to kill off MOVE because that was their intent. You don't come and evict people with hundreds of cops and firefighters and the whole bit. You don't do that just for an eviction. But that's what that police attack was supposed to be based on. In 85, the government told people through the media that it was based on neighbors complaining about MOVE. Now, we're not saying that no neighbors had any complaints about MOVE, but name me one neighborhood in this entire country where some neighbors don't have complaints against other neighbors. And just like in 78, since when does this government care about black folks complaining about their neighbors or anything else for that fact? We've been complaining since being brought to this country in chains. Have those complaints been addressed at all, really? No. But they want people. Go ahead.
And, of course, those neighbors wound up being burnt out by the bombs dropped by the first black mayor of Philadelphia.
Absolutely. And they're still suffering and paying the price till this day. 32 years later, they are still trying to work things out because the government really gave them the shaft. They didn't do right by them at all. And we tried to tell them that before the bombing, that this government didn't care about them any more than they cared about MOVE. 78 should have told them that, where they beat people up, rode horses up on people's porches and into their houses, just arrested people en masse. But they didn't listen. And they thought the government, particularly this first black mayor, was in their corner and was going to take care of everything and do right by them. Please. Not that first black mayor, the second black mayor, nor the third did anything, really, to help those residents. And you should know that some of the residents, particularly the block captain now, Gerald Renfro, who was there through the whole thing, who grew up on that block, he comes out to our programs and speaks at our programs and speaks very honestly because he will tell you, yes, I had some issues, you know, with MOVE, but we never wanted or expected anything like this to happen. And what the government is doing to them till this day. Till this day. They've had complaints about addicts just openly sitting on the steps of vacant houses. It's only a handful of houses on Osage Avenue that are occupied. The rest are vacant or abandoned. And drug addicts and junkies sit there doing their drugs. The residents that still live there, a handful, have called the cops, tried to get some help, get their block cleaned up. They get no help. They get nothing. And these residents, Gerald Renfro and his wife, and they come out and talk about that, what the city is doing to them, how they are now victims coming at the city, and they understand a little better why MOVE was talking about city officials and this government like we did and still are. They got the example firsthand.
Tell us about how you're mobilizing to affect the conditions and the cases for those who are still in prison from MOVE.
Yeah, and people should know some of our family members, the MOVE 9, lost children, lost their babies in that bombing while they were sitting not only in prison unjustly, but in the hole of prison. The MOVE 9 have been eligible for parole since 2008. That was their 30-year minimum. They have seen the parole board at least seven times since then. And each time they are denied parole, they are told they are denied because of their refusal to accept responsibility for their offenses. And MOVE is like, what offenses? We were the ones that were victimized. If you look at it, you will see that both major attacks on MOVE happened when cops and officials came out to our home attacking us. We didn't go to Rizzo's house, the police commissioner's house. We didn't go to Wilson Good's house or police commissioner's house, Gregory Sambor. They came out to our house to kill. The other thing they say, lack of remorse. MOVE is saying, okay, first of all, you want to talk about taking responsibility for your actions, for so-called offenses? When is this government ever going to take responsibility for all the decades and centuries of abuses, going back to the almost extermination of the indigenous people of this country, all of the cops that just shoot and kill innocent people? When are they going to take responsibility for that? When are they going to take responsibility for poisoning the environment that we cannot live without, the water, the air, the earth that feeds us? They have never taken responsibility, but they want to talk about MOVE taking responsibility and showing remorse for something that we did not do, and they know we did not do. So we have been coming at the parole board since 2008 for refusing to parole our family. Not only that, the institutions that our family members are in recommend MOVE people for parole, give them the highest recommendations for parole. Now, who should know better? People that are around my family and inmates every day, or somebody that sees them once a year, once every 2 years, 3 years? So that's going to be a main issue at our conference, and it's something that we're dealing with every day. The last time my brother Delbert saw the parole board, and that was maybe 2 years ago, they put on his denial form that he's a threat to the community. And we went off about that. We wrote up a letter, a petition that we get people to sign saying how that's a lie, that the parole board never talked to anybody in the community. Who are they saying feels threatened by MOVE? And also, the community is not stupid. The community knows who the real threat is. It wasn't MOVE that killed Michael Brown. It wasn't MOVE that killed Eric Garner. It wasn't MOVE that killed Freddie Gray, Sandra Blaine. The list goes on and on. It wasn't MOVE. And it's not MOVE that the community feels threatened by. It's these kill crazy cops that continuously, repeatedly get away with murder. And they want to call our family murderers, want to call Mumia a murderer, want to call Leonard Peltier a murderer, particularly Leonard. I mean, my God, this man's people were virtually killed into extinction by the ancestors of the people who want to call him a murderer. I mean, how twisted can you be? And that's why MOVE don't let them get away with that. You want to call our family murderers and other people murderers? All right, well, let's deal with who murders people, who the real murderers are.
Ramona Africa of the MOVE organization in Philadelphia.
President Donald Trump does not seem to have yet developed his own policy on Africa. That means former President Obama's policies are still largely in effect, which is not necessarily a good thing, since Obama vastly increased the U.S. military presence in Africa and continued Washington's support for friendly dictators in the region. Kambale Musavuli is a native of the Democratic Republic of Congo, the DRC, and a spokesperson for the Washington-based advocacy organization, Friends of Congo. He is particularly concerned about the lasting mark made on U.S. policy by two war hawks of the Obama administration, Samantha Powers and Susan Rice. Under their influence, the U.S. State Department created a strange new agency called the Atrocity Prevention Board. Musavuli explains.
It comes from the ideology, Samantha Power, Susan Rice, they have this notion of intervention for humanitarian crisis, and they've been developing this idea, you know, when genocide takes place around the world, we have to intervene. But the framework in which specifically Samantha Power has worked on is to intervene where U.S. interest is at stake. So, for example, they don't call for this policy when it comes to the genocide in Congo, but they call for it for Yemen, for Syria, for Darfur. But all these cases are where U.S. interests are at stake. So coming out from her being in the D.C. circles and then joining the U.S. administration as a U.S. ambassador, and Susan Rice going into the White House under Obama as a special advisor, these two have been able to get Barack Obama to sign an executive order creating what they call an Atrocity Prevention Board. So within the White House under Obama, you had a board that decide which country has the most important atrocities that the U.S. has to militarily intervene. And it's only for U.S. interests. And, of course, as I mentioned, for the Congo, that does not apply. Not that I want the U.S. to actually military intervene in DRC. So, as he signed the executive order, it's been implemented. The board has been created. There are people within the National Security Office who have been, before Trump, managing that process. They've created documentations, training for Foreign Service staff. So if any young U.S. citizen decides to join the Foreign Service of the United States government, they go through a genocide training. It's kind of funny, even the way it's written, is you learn how to do genocide or to prevent genocide. But that's what they have been doing under the Obama administration. What is unclear right now is if Donald Trump will continue to enforce that Atrocity Prevention Board executive order, as we're seeing that, you know, he has not publicly provided an Africa policy. And I suspect that his Africa policy will not be any different than Barack Obama or George Bush or Clinton. The Democrats and the Republicans have had similar policies in Africa where they've supported the so-called strongman, the dictators, the African leaders who serve U.S. interests. So it is to see, but I'm not waiting to find out. But as of now, it is unclear if the Trump administration will continue with the Atrocity Board. But now for your listeners, you know, they may hear this and wonder, well, that's a great thing that, you know, Obama really cares about people being killed, creating actually a board. But it needs to be very clear, this is not to help these countries. Some of the conflict that we see around the world sometimes starts with us funding rebels. And I remember a few years ago, looking on the front page of the New York Times, something that I never thought that I would ever see. There was an article explaining how the CIA is training rebels in Syria. like on the front page. And then you hear the Secretary of State talking about, yes, we are involved in training rebels. That reminded me so much of the Congo, where in 1996, we had a war of invasion by Rwanda and Uganda. And there was this discussion around the intervention to remove the long-time dictator Mobutu Sese Seko, and that the United States was in support of that invasion because it was time for that dictator to actually leave power. That was 96, 97. And looking back from that time, because of U.S. policy to support that invasion, we have lost over 6 million Congolese. And we maybe never will ever know how many people have died there. So it's not a good policy necessarily for the U.S. to be the police of the world, and specifically to choose when convenient where to use U.S. military to protect their interest.
And these 6 million or more people, which represents the biggest genocide in the world since World War II, it's not part of the genocide training that they instituted by the United States.
They do not learn anything about the DRC in that genocide training, unfortunately. Actually, I may even say fortunately, because, as I said, I'm not in support of the United States militarily intervening in DRC or anywhere around the world, especially when some of these conflicts are sometimes fueled by the United States government. And this is really painful to even discuss, because it seems that when it comes to the United States government, in terms of policy, they have not learned that one will look at it critically and say that if you keep repeating the same thing over and over, you must be crazy. Then one must pose the question. Maybe they actually know that the policies that they implement does not work, but there is another intention. Maybe this is about the military-industrial complex, how many weapons we can sell, how many places we can destabilize to get access to cheaper resources. Because someone who has any sense in the head will know that you should not go and send your military to Vietnam, right? You should not go and support the assassination and participate in the assassination of the first democratically elected prime minister of the DRC, Patrice Lumumba. You should not support a dictator for 32 years. You should not support the invasion of the DRC. But this policy continued to happen, and always very critical of U.S. youth whenever some of them join the United States government, because they end up advising the president in certain policy matters without even understanding this 20-some-year-old, I would say Princeton, Stanford graduate, working at the State Department or at the White House, providing the U.S. president advice on a military intervention that affects lives of people. I mean, I will always say that the only reason I live in the United States, I became a refugee because of a U.S. policy matter, not because of a war in Congo. Someone in Washington decided to support a war in DRC, and it has caused over 2 million Congolese to become refugees around the world. And it's interesting now in the United States that when you talk about immigrants, we have to build these walls, we have to send them back. I say, well, you need to stop bombing us. You need to stop killing us. We will not be leaving our countries if our countries were not in war. Why would I come to a place where winter is below 0 degrees, where I can live in DRC in the good weather? The only reason I cannot live there is because of war, because of despots that we support. So those are some of the contradictions that happen with U.S. foreign policy at the moment.
Well, certainly U.S. foreign policy, its real foreign policy, not its stated one, apparently does work. People of the Congo do not control their mineral resources or their government, and yet the United States has all the access it wants to those resources.
Yes, and this policy of the United States since Congo's modern-day founding, many people do not know that the United States actually was the first country to recognize Congo as the personal property of King Leopold II of Belgium in 1885 during the Berlin Conference. They will not know also that during World War I, Congolese provided their citizens to go fight this war, their mineral resources to rebuild Europe. Same thing happened in World War II. People will not even know that we provided not just the raw materials and the people. I mean, we can even bring up the case of Japan. Hiroshima and Nagasaki was bombed by uranium extracted in Chikolombo in Katanga in the Congo. of course, through Belgian hands, who controlled the Congo, and then gave it to the United States through that so-called Manhattan Project. And when the Congolese were successful electing their leader, the United States, with Eisenhower as a president, felt that there is no way in the world a young man, age 24 at the time, could control a country the size of Western Europe, called Congo, with mineral wealth such as cobalt, needed to build the airplanes in the United States to make missiles and so on. So there is no way we will let that country be in the hands of Africans, in the hand of Patrice Lumumba, in the hands of the Congolese people. So what did the United States do in 1960? They overthrew Patrice Lumumba with the help of Congolese sycophants, and they worked to assassinate him, and they were successful. The CIA was successful in the assassination of Patrice Lumumba on January 17, 1961, but that wasn't all. After the assassination of Patrice Lumumba, they sent mercenaries to quell the rebellions in the Congo for 4 years, and they installed a dictator there for 32 years, Mobutu. And when they got tired of him, instead of letting again the Congolese people choose their own leader, they supported an invasion of the Congo that has destabilized the Congo, taking the lives of millions, but they continue to do that by also the current president of the DRC, Joseph Kabila, who is not loved by the Congo, who is not wanted, who is actually staying beyond his presidential term limit. He's been in Congo now for two terms limit. He's staying in power against the constitution. But this man would not have been in power without the support of the United States. So Congolese are very well aware of the U.S. role in the destabilization of the Congo. So U.S. citizens who are not aware of what the U.S. is doing in Africa and in the Congo.
But now the United States is acting as if it is tired of Kabila as well.
And we've been here before, and this is what's worrisome. I think we've done a few shows speaking about how the USAID have been very active, not just in Congo, but on the African continent, supporting youth training, coming up with this youth movement, using hashtags and building social movement. But they don't call them social movement. They call this movement citizens' movement, not social movement. So if you hear this citizens' movement, youth movement on the African continent, specifically in the DRC, you know that is a way of the U.S. infiltrating the system to try to change the situation, not for the interest of the Congolese people, of course, but again, to make sure that if there is change in Congo, the U.S. has a say in it. But why so? Because someone would say, well, Kabila should be happy. Finally, the American government is on the side of the Congolese people. I've read history. Kabila will not be in power if he wasn't for the United States. He is the United States monster. They created the monster. They have the right to remove him whenever they want. That's what they've done for any leader they've propped up. But what is clear, the Congolese are not just fighting for Kabila to leave power. We want to be free from the shackles that have held us since 1885. We want to make sure that whenever we have a leader in the Congo, they're not waiting to hear what the World Bank is writing in terms of their economic reports, if there is inflation or anything of that nature. We don't want our leaders to fly into Washington and London and Paris and come back to the Congo and say, well, the West is okay with the opposition. Those are the things of the past, and we know it never works. So Congolese are and want to be able to elect their leaders freely, to be able to control their own affairs without any intervention of the outside. And that's fearful. And this is why also the United States has been forced to take this action because of the reality on the ground. The majority of the Congolese population are young people under the age of 18. We could say 60 to 70% of the population is under the age of 35. So any political action in DRC automatically engages the youth, and of course, again, the population is majority women. So if they know that the population of the Congo with 95% of unemployment are tired of the system, are protesting and organizing that it will blow up, if there is an uprising in DRC that is successful, it will stop the direct transfer of mineral resources of the DRC to go to the outside. There won't be no cobalt coming out of the Congo. There won't be no zinc, no copper, no uranium going out of the Congo. So when these minerals don't go out, it affects Western economies. So we want to make sure if there is a change in the DRC, those new leaders who are coming in are leaders that we control, and that's the struggle that we are waging right now.
The United States is trying to influence who those new leaders will be, grooming selected young people and bringing them here to the United States.
I know. It's quite unfortunate. I've had a lot of debates with young people who participate in those training programs that the United States has been holding under Barack Obama. For example, when Barack Obama became president, 2 years after he became president, he created this program called YALI, Young African Leadership Initiative, where he started bringing African youth leaders from the continent to the United States to provide them with some leadership training. First, outside of looking at how problematic that process is, that just gives you a sense of how they think about Africa. That you have to take an African from the continent, miles away, to teach them leadership. So in their head, consciously, they don't believe that Africans can be a leader, that we have to teach them in Washington how to be a leader. Secondly, the issue that I've had about this is it has created an elite youth group whereby, because they've taken a picture with Barack Obama in Washington, because they have a certificate of excellence or participation that's been given to them by the State Department with the eagle on the certificate, it provides them with some form of political credibility that when they go back on the ground in their respective country, they found themselves being interviewed by media, getting access to radio station and putting out propaganda.
So they are already being treated at home as if they are leaders.
Exactly. And they've been taken from people who never worked on any movement to people who can provide analysis and have even access to the political scene without any political background or any grassroots work they've ever done. And these are the leaders of the African continent that we'll have to contend with for the next 50 years, because according to their website, according to the U.S. government website of the YALI program, there is a network of 100,000 African youth who have participated in this project. And I'm worried, because I do not see China, for example, taking U.S. youth for a 3 month leadership training in China, and the U.S. government, actually, you're still not even talking about China. Let's make it very clear. Let's change the topic. What if Russia today had a youth training in Moscow, bringing young U.S. youth to train them about leadership, and then coming back after the 3 months training, what would Hillary Clinton say? But how come the United States government can do that action without any criticism from any side within the country? I'm not hearing any criticism from political groups or for movements inside of the United States. And it seems that they're not even aware that this has gone on under Barack Obama. Again, with Donald Trump now president, as I mentioned, we do not know what this policy is going to be. We do not know if it's going to continue. But we have now created a cadre generation of U.S.-trained African youth leaders who, unfortunately, will implement changes that don't change the status quo. These young people, whenever you start seeing some of the actions that they're doing around electoral voting, that in the case of the DRC, they are talking about they want for Kabila to leave power. They want to participate in the national dialogue. That's not fundamentally changing the system. People are not interested in the electoral law anymore. They're seeing the conditions they've lived in, and they want a radical shift, a radical change in their livelihood, and electoral politics will not do that. And that's the same aspiration of U.S. youth. When I'm in the United States and I'm seeing young people who are in majority, not looking into electoral politics, that they are understanding how they live in a police state, they are attacked every day, they don't have their basic needs met, they're not going out there, at least some of the youths that I know in the United States, they're not going out there saying, I am going to vote for Hillary Clinton so that Trump is not president. They're saying that their local issues is different from electoral politics. And until local communities are taking control of their reality, what we see in the politics is not going to change.
And in fact, in Congo, one could anticipate that if elections did not go the way the United States wanted, it always has that little stick with lots of weapons at the end of the tip, Rwanda, to intercede militarily again.
Yes, and if you look at the region, you know, while they are being very strong with the regime of Kabila saying that he must hold elections, he must stand down after the election is done, not run for a third term, I agree that Kabila should not run. I don't need to hear that from the United States. You know, that's what the Congolese constitution is. But they're not saying the same thing for Rwanda. You know? President Paul Kagame of Rwanda, who is a United States ally on the so-called war on terror, has been in power for now almost a decade. He has changed the constitution in his country. He's going to run again for a third term and probably stay there for decades, over another decade or so. Same thing in Uganda. President Museveni has been in power since 1986. He has changed the constitution numerous times, and he's standing to run again for presidency. So imagine, since 1986, he's been in power with U.S. support.
He was Ronald Reagan's favorite African.
Exactly. And every single one after that. Ronald Reagan, Bill Clinton, George Bush, and also Barack Obama, because they have not done anything to look at the challenges of the Ugandans and the Rwandans and what they're suffering, how they are killed, they are imprisoned. So it's really the whole region. We know when it comes to U.S. foreign policy on the African continent, specifically in that region where you have Congo, Rwanda, and Uganda, the U.S. government, they have been hypocrites. I mean, they have supported desolation, and when convenient, they put out a few condemnation here and there without fundamentally changing what is happening. And that's why I don't hope for change of U.S. foreign policy.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.